A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking how far back we can trace graffiti, and how different countries handle the tension between free expression on walls and keeping public spaces orderly. He's wondering whether there's been a global policy shift, or if it just varies country by country. And honestly, this is one of those topics where the history is way deeper than most people realize, and the policy side is a complete patchwork.
It really is. I want to start with a moment from last year that captures the whole tension in one story. Melbourne, 2025, someone puts up a Banksy-style stencil on a laneway wall. Beautiful piece, very clearly inspired by his visual language. The city council removes it within hours. And the debate that erupted was exactly the one we're going to unpack. Is this art or vandalism? And why does the same city that runs street art walking tours also scrub new work off the walls before most people even see it?
The left hand selling tickets to the graffiti tour, the right hand holding a pressure washer.
That whiplash is worth something like $1.2 billion a year globally now. Street art tourism has become a serious economic force. Paris and Sao Paulo have both legalized certain murals. So the line between crime and culture is blurring in real time, and different cities are drawing it in wildly different places.
Where do we even start with something that spans 17,000 years? And about 190 legal systems.
Let's define the thing first, quickly, because the scope matters. Graffiti, broadly, is any unauthorized marking on public or private property. That covers ancient Roman wall scratchings, 1970s New York subway tags, and something like digital projection graffiti that doesn't even leave a physical mark. The key word is unauthorized. That's what separates it from a commissioned mural. Same image, same wall, same paint. But permission flips the legal category entirely.
Which is already a little absurd when you think about it. The content doesn't change. The aesthetic doesn't change. Just whether someone signed a form.
And that form, that permission structure, is a very modern invention. For most of history, nobody was asking. So here's our structure for this episode. First, we're going to trace graffiti from its earliest known examples through to the modern street art movement. Then we'll do a comparative policy dive across six countries with very different approaches. The core question running through all of it is, who gets to decide what belongs on public walls, and how has that power shifted over time?
I think the answer is going to surprise people, because it's not a story of steady liberalization or steady crackdown. It's more like a pendulum that swings differently in different rooms.
Let's start with the deep history, because this is where most coverage gets it wrong. People talk about graffiti like it started in 1970s Philadelphia. It didn't. The earliest known examples are the cave paintings at Lascaux, 17,000 years ago. Now, those are pictorial, and you could argue whether they count as graffiti in the strict sense. But written graffiti? That's about 2,000 years old, and the single best window into it is Pompeii.
Pompeii is the gift that keeps on giving. Preserved by volcanic ash, and suddenly you've got the social media of 79 CE scratched onto every wall.
It's exactly that. The Romans wrote on everything. Political slogans, love notes, insults, advertisements for gladiator fights, caricatures of political figures. There's an inscription from Pompeii, catalogued as CIL 4-7698-1, that reads, and I'm quoting, "I wonder, O wall, that you have not fallen into ruin, since you support the tedious scribblings of so many writers."
A meta-complaint about graffiti, written as graffiti. That is genuinely perfect.
It's the ancient equivalent of someone writing, "Stop writing on this wall," on a wall. But what's striking is the range. There's another Pompeii inscription, "The one who loves, let him prosper, let him perish, who knows not love." That's deeply personal. And then right next to it, you might have Gaius and Aulus are running for office, vote for them. Political and personal, side by side, same medium.
Nobody was arresting people for this.
There were some restrictions. Defacing certain public monuments or religious sites could get you in trouble. But the general attitude was permissive. Walls were public communication surfaces. That's a fundamentally different cultural assumption than what we have now.
The first big shift isn't the invention of graffiti. It's the invention of the idea that walls are private.
And that shift takes centuries. Through the medieval period, you get pilgrim graffiti in churches, markings left by travelers at the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem from the 12th century onward. You get ship graffiti scratched into maritime structures by sailors. By the 16th century, European guilds were using tags as territorial markers. The impulse to leave your mark is constant. What changes is who owns the surface.
The medieval church graffiti is interesting because it was often devotional. I was here. I made this pilgrimage. This matters. It's not defacement in the eyes of the person doing it. It's witness.
That tension between the marker's intent and the property owner's perspective is the entire modern legal debate in a nutshell. Now, the big turning point for what we'd recognize as modern graffiti culture comes in the 1960s and 70s in the United States, and it starts with a specific person. A teenager named Daryl McRae starts writing, "Cornbread loves Cynthia" all over the city. He's trying to get a girl's attention. It works, sort of. He becomes locally famous. And the act of writing your name, your tag, in as many places as possible becomes the foundational gesture of modern graffiti.
From love note to movement. That's a pretty good origin story.
Then in 1971, a Greek-American kid in New York City, Taki 183, starts tagging his name all over the subway system. The New York Times profiles him in an article titled, "Taki 183 Spawns Pen Pals." And suddenly, thousands of kids are doing it. The subway car becomes the canvas of choice because it moves. Your tag travels across the city, seen by millions. It's the original viral medium.
Built-in distribution network. No algorithm required.
The art form evolved fast. It went from simple signatures to elaborate pieces, wild-style lettering, characters, full car murals. By the late 1970s, you had artists like Lee Quinones and Lady Pink creating serious work on subway cars. The aesthetic complexity exploded.
That's when the city started treating it as a crisis, right?
1972 is the key year. New York passes the first major anti-graffiti ordinance in the United States, the No Tagging Ordinance. It criminalized possession of graffiti implements, including markers and spray cans, in public spaces. This was the beginning of the legal framework we still basically operate in, and it framed graffiti as a public order problem, not an expression problem.
Which is a choice. They could have framed it as free speech, but they went with broken windows.
That choice shaped decades of policy. Now, parallel to the art movement, there's always been a political graffiti tradition, and this is where the stakes get much higher than cleanup costs. Think about the 1989 Tiananmen Square protests. The image of the tank man became one of the most powerful political symbols of the 20th century, and a lot of the protest signage and wall writing from those weeks was graffiti in the purest sense. Unauthorized, public, political.
The Arab Spring in 2011. Walls in Cairo and Tunis covered in tags demanding the end of regimes. And then 2014. Hong Kong's umbrella movement, with stencils and slogans on every available surface. Graffiti in those contexts is basically a low-cost, high-impact broadcast system when other media are controlled.
That's exactly why authoritarian states treat it as an existential threat, not a nuisance. We'll come back to that in the policy section. But let's bridge to the modern era, because there's one more historical inflection point worth naming, the Banksy effect.
The anonymous British artist who turned stencil work into a global commodity.
Banksy's work started appearing in Bristol in the 1990s. By the 2000s, his pieces were selling for hundreds of thousands at auction. And what he did, more than any single artist before him, was force a public conversation about whether unsanctioned public art could be culturally valuable regardless of its legality. Cities that once scrubbed graffiti started putting plexiglass over Banksy pieces to preserve them.
Which is the Melbourne paradox in its purest form. Same act, same illegality, but if the market decides it's valuable, suddenly the pressure washer gets put away.
That paradox shapes policy everywhere now. So let's move to the comparative analysis. We've seen that graffiti is as old as writing itself. How do modern governments actually deal with it? I want to look at six countries across three axes: their legal tradition, common law versus civil law, their cultural attitude toward public space, and their political freedom index, because those three factors explain almost all the variation.
Start with the United States, since that's where the modern legal framework was born.
Approach is governed by the First Amendment, which protects speech but not property damage. The key Supreme Court case here is City of Cincinnati versus Discovery Network from 1993. It ruled that commercial speech on news racks was protected, but the reasoning implicitly excluded graffiti because the Speech Act is inseparable from property defacement. You can say almost anything you want, but you can't say it on someone else's wall without permission.
The speech itself isn't criminalized, but the medium makes it criminal.
And enforcement varies enormously by city. New York in the 1990s under Giuliani adopted broken windows policing, zero tolerance for graffiti as part of a broader public order strategy. San Francisco, by contrast, launched a legal walls program in 2020 where designated spaces are open for graffiti artists. Same country, same constitution, completely different approaches. In 2023, New York established graffiti-free zones around certain commercial corridors, effectively zero tolerance with enhanced penalties. Meanwhile, cities like Austin and Portland have commissioned murals and created legal spaces. Doesn't have a national graffiti policy. It has about 18,000 local ones.
The American approach is basically let 100 flowers bloom and also let 100 flowers get power washed.
That's the Federalist bargain. Now, the United Kingdom takes a different legal path. The Criminal Damage Act of 1971 makes graffiti a criminal offense, plain and simple. But the 2003 Anti-Social Behavior Act introduced on-the-spot fines of £80, so you get a bifurcated system where serious cases go criminal and minor, tagging gets administrative penalties.
Yet Bristol, Banksy's hometown, launched a legal street art program in 2022 that commissioned large-scale murals. So you've got the same city that produced the world's most famous illegal street artists now officially paying for street art.
That tension is everywhere. The UK also has something called the Graffiti Removal Task Force in London, which coordinates rapid cleanup. But at the same time, areas like Shoreditch have become street art destinations where building owners actually request murals to increase property values. The policy is officially tough, but the practice is selectively permissive.
What about France? They've got that civil law tradition and a very different relationship to public aesthetics.
France is fascinating because the law is harsh, but the practice is increasingly permissive. Under Article 322-1 of the 1994 Penal Code, graffiti can bring fines up to €45,000 and prison time. That's not messing around. But Paris's 13th arrondissement has become one of the world's great legal street art hubs since 2017, with over 40 large-scale murals commissioned by the city itself.
The state is both the prosecutor and the patron.
And that's not a contradiction to the French. It's a distinction between vandalism and art that the state feels competent to make. The French cultural establishment has always been comfortable with state curation of aesthetics. So graffiti that meets certain artistic standards and goes through the permission process is elevated. Everything else is criminal damage.
Brazil takes this distinction and writes it directly into the law, which is maybe the most explicit version of this anywhere.
This is one of my favorite examples. Brazil's 1998 environmental crimes law criminalized graffiti broadly. But then in 2009, they passed Law 12408, which explicitly legalized graphite, artistic graffiti done with consent, while keeping pichação illegal. Pichação is the distinctive angular tagging style that originated in São Paulo, often done on high-rise buildings and considered much more aggressive.
They didn't just legalize some graffiti. They legalized a category based on aesthetic merit and permission, and criminalized another category based on form.
That's deeply controversial. Critics say it's class-based. Graphite is associated with middle-class artists, pichação with favela youth. São Paulo's Cidade Linda program in 2017 painted over favela murals as part of a city beautification effort, which sparked massive backlash from communities who saw it as erasure.
Beautiful city, as a cover for removing poor people's art from walls. That's not subtle.
It really isn't. And the debate in Brazil is still very live. The legal distinction exists on paper, but enforcement is wildly inconsistent and often targets marginalized communities.
Let's go to Japan, because the cultural context there is almost the inverse of Brazil's.
Japan is a clean case of cultural norms driving policy. The 2001 Minor Offenses Act prohibits graffiti with fines up to 10,000 yen. That's about $65. The penalties aren't draconian. But graffiti is rare because the cultural emphasis on social harmony and public cleanliness is so strong. Writing on a wall without permission is almost unthinkable in many Japanese contexts.
It's social enforcement more than legal enforcement.
And when graffiti does appear, it's often in very specific zones. Tokyo's Harajuku graffiti wall was a rare legal space created in 2023, but it's the exception that proves the rule. Most Japanese cities have almost no visible graffiti. The walls are clean not because the police are everywhere, but because the social norm against defacing shared space is deeply internalized.
Which brings us to the hardest case, Iran, where graffiti isn't about cleanliness or aesthetics. It's about life and death.
Under Iran's Islamic Penal Code, anti-regime graffiti can lead to flogging or execution. This is not a nuisance crime. The state sees political wall writing as a direct challenge to its legitimacy. And yet, during the 2022 Mahsa Amini protests, walls across Iran were covered in stencils of Woman, Life, Freedom, the Kurdish slogan that became the protest rallying cry.
Graffiti as the canary in the coal mine for political freedom. When people are willing to risk execution to write on a wall, you know the regime is terrified of what that wall says.
That's the extreme end of the spectrum that helps us understand the whole thing. In authoritarian states, graffiti isn't a property crime, it's an act of sedition. The wall becomes a contested political space because other spaces for dissent are closed. When you can't publish, broadcast, or assemble, you write on walls.
Let's pull back. We've got six countries, six completely different approaches. Treats graffiti as a local property issue with constitutional speech limits. The UK criminalizes it, but selectively tolerates it in creative districts. France prosecutes harshly while commissioning murals down the street. Brazil draws an explicit legal line between art and vandalism that critics say is classist. Japan relies on social norms more than law. And Iran treats it as a potential capital offense.
The question the prompt asks is there a global trend? And I think the answer is no. Policy varies more by country than by era. The only consistent finding in the research is that legal graffiti spaces reduce illegal tagging. Cities like Melbourne in 2024 and Lisbon in 2023 saw about a 40% reduction in illegal tagging within 12 months of creating designated legal walls. But most cities still don't adopt them.
If the data's that clear, why isn't every city doing it?
Because graffiti policy isn't really about effectiveness. It's about values. A city that sees graffiti primarily as disorder will always default to cleanup and enforcement, regardless of what the data says about legal walls. A city that sees graffiti as cultural expression will tolerate more of it. The policy follows the worldview.
Graffiti regulation is a Rorschach test for how a society feels about public space and who belongs in it.
And you can see this playing out in real time with what I'd call the Banksy effect, the way a single artist has become a policy catalyst. After Banksy created a series of murals in Ukraine in 2023, Kyiv legalized street art in 2024. Same year, Moscow intensified its anti-graffiti patrols. Same artist, same moment, opposite policy responses.
Because in Kyiv, the murals were seen as solidarity and cultural defiance. In Moscow, they were seen as a threat. The paint didn't change. The political context did.
That pattern is ancient, honestly. Go back to Pompeii. Political slogans on walls were normal in a relatively open society. Fast forward to any authoritarian regime, and the first thing they control is what appears in public space. The wall is the original public square.
Let me try to synthesize the big insight here. The history of graffiti is basically the history of who controls public space. For most of human history, walls were common property in practice, if not in law. The modern era invented the idea that a wall is private, and writing on it is a crime. And now we're in this weird transitional period where some walls are being recommoned through legal graffiti programs, while other walls are more heavily policed than ever.
That's a great framing. And the transition isn't linear. It's not like we're moving from criminalization to legalization. We're moving toward fragmentation. Different rules for different walls and different cities for different kinds of writers.
Which is probably the messiest possible outcome from a legal clarity standpoint, but maybe the most human. We can't make up our minds about graffiti because we can't make up our minds about public space.
Let's dig into some of the misconceptions that float around this topic, because they shape policy in unhelpful ways. The first and biggest is that graffiti is a modern phenomenon. We've already busted that. 17,000 years of cave painting, 2,000 years of written graffiti. This is not a 1970s invention.
The second misconception, all graffiti is vandalism. And this one is tricky because legally, unauthorized marking is vandalism by definition. But culturally, we all know that's not how we actually judge it. Nobody looks at a Banksy and says, that's vandalism, in the same tone they'd use for a random tag on a mailbox.
That inconsistency is exactly what cities struggle with. Do you enforce the law uniformly, which means scrubbing art that the public values, or do you make judgment calls, which opens you to charges of elitism and arbitrariness?
The third misconception. Graffiti is always political. Most of it isn't. Most graffiti throughout history has been personal. Names, love notes, territorial markers, jokes. The Pompeii Wall had political slogans and romantic poetry on the same surface. Political graffiti is a highly visible minority, but it gets disproportionate attention because the stakes are higher.
That's important for policy. If you design laws around political graffiti, you're designing for the exception. Most illegal tagging is not a protest, it's a kid with a marker. Treating every tag as sedition is how you get Iran's policies. Treating every tag as harmless expression is how you get the cleanup cost problem, which, by the way, is estimated at $8 to $12 billion globally per year.
That's a real number. That's not abstract.
It's enormous. And that's why the legal wall approach is so interesting. It doesn't eliminate the cost, but it channels the impulse into spaces where cleanup isn't the property owner's burden. The 40% reduction in illegal tagging that Melbourne and Lisbon saw isn't zero, but it's meaningful.
What actually works? If we're trying to extract practical takeaways from this global tour, what's the closest thing to a best practice?
The data points pretty consistently to designated legal spaces as the most effective approach, not zero tolerance and not blanket legalization. Zero tolerance is expensive and doesn't work. People still tag. You just spend more on cleanup and enforcement. Blanket legalization creates its own problems. If every wall is fair game, you lose the ability to protect historic buildings or residential areas.
Designated spaces plus rapid cleanup of illegal tagging. That's the Melbourne model.
It's spreading. Lisbon adopted it in 2023. Several German cities have had versions of it for years. Berlin's Mauerpark has been a legal graffiti space since 2009. The key is that you need enough legal space in enough locations that the barrier to legal expression is lower than the barrier to illegal expression. If the only legal wall is in one distant neighborhood, it won't work.
The second takeaway I'd offer is that political graffiti is a barometer. If you want to measure a country's political freedom, look at its walls. Not just whether graffiti exists. It exists everywhere. But what happens to the people who write it? Are they fined? Or are they disappeared?
The Mahsa Amini protests made that brutally clear. The woman, life, freedom stencils weren't just slogans. They were acts of defiance where the penalty for getting caught was potentially death. That's a very different calculus than a kid tagging a subway car in Brooklyn.
What should a listener do with all this, beyond being more informed when they walk past a tag?
A few concrete things. Support local legal wall initiatives if your city has them or is considering them. Document political graffiti when you see it. Not in a way that endangers the writers, but as historical record. A lot of the most important political wall writing from past movements is lost because it was painted over before anyone recorded it. And third, understand that the eyesore versus art debate is a proxy. When people argue about whether a mural is beautiful or ugly, they're often really arguing about who belongs in that neighborhood and who gets to shape its visual identity.
The aesthetics argument is almost never just about aesthetics.
It's about power. It's always about power. Who has the right to leave a mark, and whose marks get erased? That's the question that runs from Pompeii to Philadelphia to Tehran.
Next time you see a tag on a wall, ask yourself, is this a crime, or is this a 17,000-year-old tradition? And the answer is usually both.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The world's largest known lava tube is the Kazumura Cave in Hawaii, stretching over 40 miles, but the longest ice cave formed within a lava tube is in Greenland's Disco Island region, first documented by Norse settlers in the early Renaissance period around the 1490s, who described it as a frozen throat into the earth.
A frozen throat into the earth. That's vivid.
A lot to sit with.
Let's close with the open question that I think is unsettled. As AI-generated graffiti becomes more common, projection mapping, robotic sprayers, drone-based wall writing, will the law keep up? There was a case in London in 2025 where an AI-generated stencil of the Prime Minister appeared on a building and was removed within hours. Same old tension, unauthorized public image, rapid state response. But the artist wasn't a person with a spray can, it was someone with a projector and a model.
That raises new questions. If no permanent mark is left, is it still criminal damage? If an algorithm generates the image, who's the artist for free speech purposes? And with climate activism increasingly using graffiti, the Just Stop Oil wall tags from 2024, for example, we're going to see more legal battles over whether graffiti can be protected speech under environmental protest exemptions.
The wall is the original public square, and the fight over who gets to write on it isn't going away. It's just getting weirder tools.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find every episode at My Weird Prompts.
If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you listen. We'll be back next week with another one.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.